Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. The mass shooting at a gay nightclub in Orlando this month has raised uncomfortable questions about Islam and homophobia. On tonight's show, we look at a group for whom the Orlando shooting was particularly complicated, gay Muslims. Often doubly marginalized, gay Muslims have often had to negotiate an identity despite the Islamophobia of a post-9/11 America and the homophobia of their Muslim community and families. What does the Quran actually say about homosexuality? How do LGBT Muslims reconcile their sexuality with their faith? And what is special about the experience of American gay Muslims? To discuss all this and more, I'm pleased to be joined tonight by three guests. Ani Zonneveld, she's president and founder of Muslims for Progressive Values, co-editor of Progressive Muslim Identities, Personal Stories from the U.S. and Canada, and she's also an imam based in Los Angeles. Welcome, Ani.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We're also joined by Rola Selbach. She is award-winning filmmaker of Three Veils, creator of the web series Kiss Her, I'm Famous, and the creator and host of Girl's Guide to Filmmaking. Welcome, Rola.
Hey, thanks for having me. Hello to the other guests as well.
And I want to welcome back to the program Yunus Morshid. He is an adjunct professor of communication studies at Cal State East Bay, Fulbright scholar with a master's in communication and linguistics and a doctoral degree in international and intercultural education. Welcome back, Yunus.
Glad to be with you, Joseph, and I'm glad you're having this conversation. It's a very important conversation to be had.
And of course, we invite our listeners to this conversation to participate. We'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes, and I'll give you that phone number now. It's 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can also email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw, post a comment at the KALW website, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So, Ani Zonneveld, I want to start with you. Let's get a few things out in the open here about what Islam says about homosexuality. What does the Quran say about homosexuality, if anything?
The crux of the bottom line is there is no punishment for being a homosexual in the Quran. And Prophet Muhammad never persecuted anyone for being a homosexual. So, I mean, that is the basis for which we advocate our position, that is support of LGBTQ rights within the context of Islam. The distortion or the bastardization of the sacred text happens with this so-called the interpretation of the story of Lot, which is also in the Old Testament, and that the city was destroyed as a result of homosexual acts. But in contemporary and progressive Christianity as well, it is the story is reinterpreted in that the destruction of that city was from Prophet Lot was not because of a homosexual act. It was because of the inhospitality. It was because they defied Prophet Lot. It was because of the violence, sexual violence, that sex as used as a tool to oppress. And we still have this issue in the modern world in times of war where women and others and are being persecuted or punished in sexual ways. So that is the crux of the story. So there is no punishment, bottom line, in Quran. And there is the same light that there is in the Old Testament, and that is anal sex is forbidden, is prohibited. But there is no punishment for it. So the fact that homophobic teachings are promoted in schools, in religious institutions, is the challenge, and this is what we've been challenging American Muslim institutions in particular, because it has no basis in the Quran, and it is simply unacceptable.
So you speak there scripture that is also in the Old Testament. How is the interpretation of that different in Islam compared to Christianity, or how is it similar, or Judaism for that matter?
Right, it's similar in the use of or the distortion of the interpretation of Lot, the prophet Lot, in the destruction of that of the city. So it's used in the same manner. to demonize LGBT people. They're doomed. It's a sin. You cannot be gay and Muslim, just as you can't be Christians and gay. You are, you know, condemned to hell. And for some of the radical imams, it is even like to kill them is to be merciful. I mean, you know, some of the rhetoric is advocating for violence.
Merciful so, towards the person who is LGBT?
Yes, towards the LGBT individual, correct. So, you know, as an American Muslim, this is no basis. Now, historically, too, the Muslim world was not homophobic. We had lots of LGBT people, homosexuals, that contributed to science, to the arts, and poetry. I mean, it's evident in our literature. And what happened is colonialism, and along with it came the Christian interpretation of homosexuality and how that was criminalized. One of the excuses the West used in conquering Muslim world was because we were so uncivilized and morally corrupt because we were so homosexually friendly. And as a result, that was one of the excuses why criminalization of homosexuality was indoctrinated and became constitutional and became law in Muslim majority countries. But not only just Muslim majority countries, but also like India. They're still struggling with that, trying to get rid of these the British rules. So when we got our independence, we adopted those laws and we stuck with it and we made it worse and we actually embraced it, unfortunately. And that, coupled with Wahhabism, the Salafi, the radical interpretation of Islam, it just, you know, it's like the perfect storm.
So I want to turn then to Yunus Morshid next. So you've worked with or studied, met with gay Muslims. And how does that translate? How does what Ani has said in the beginning, how does that translate into the lived experience of gay Muslims? And I'd ask you to perhaps talk as best you can about not only gay Muslims here in America, but perhaps in other parts of the world.
Yeah, that, I think Rola has really highlighted the major, you know, elements in about the jurisprudence and the what Islam says about homosexuality. And there are about 7 verses in the Quran that speak about homosexuality, and they speak about it as a sinful, devious act, but they do not. There is no mention at all of any punishment. However, what happened, the different schools of jurisprudence, you know, the Hanafite and the Hanbalite and the Shafi'i school, they all had some kind of thoughts about the punishment, and some of these punishments are incredibly devastating. That includes death. So to speak to the many gay Muslims that I've spoken to in a period of 5 years, I had a chance to speak to over 150 members of the LGBT Muslim community that lives in North America, the United States, Canada, and in Europe, mostly in Britain and France. They are very much aware of what the Quran says. They're very much aware about what the schools of jurisprudence say. And they're mostly very much aware of how their communities have interpreted everything about homosexuality and how they need to negotiate that in terms of their coming out. So so it's and I found there to be 3 groups of individuals who have negotiated this identity, their religious identity, and their sexual identity. There is the group, about 25% of my subjects in my data, that have really lived a life of what we call the down low, where they went ahead and married a woman, and behind the scenes they were having same-sex relationships, and it was very secretive. That is something that other members of other religious communities as well share. And then there is the second category of gay Muslims who were able to come out to themselves, to accept their homosexuality, to come out to some very close friends who are not necessarily from the Muslim community, and keep their families and their immediate communities at bay. And I will get to an explanation why gay Muslims face a certain challenge that Christian Muslims and Jewish Muslims and Mormon Muslims do not, gay Jewish folks and Mormon gays do not face. And then there is a third category, about 20% of my data, of individuals who were able to reconcile their sexual identity with their religious identity. They found what is beautiful about their religion, and they accepted it, and they understood the environment where they live. And they also were able to come out, some of them, to their families, to their immediate families, and negotiate how that's going to look like. But Muslims... gay Muslims are really living in two different spaces. There is the space of contending and defending their faith, and then there is the space where they have to defend themselves against homophobia. So it's a double edge. And when the events in Orlando happened, it was really very, very difficult for many of gay Muslims in the United States, because they felt that there was an attack on their sexual identity, and at the same time there was a fear and a backlash and the rise of Islamophobia as a result of the fact that the person who committed the crime has ties to the Muslim community. So it's really a double edge, and it's incredibly complicated, and I hope that we get to tease out some of these layers in the rest of the show.
All right. Thank you very much, Eunice Morshed. You were attributing some comments there originally to Rola. That was Ani Zonneveld who spoke at the beginning of the hour.
I apologize. Yes, I apologize.
No worries.
No worries.
So to bring Rola Selbach into the conversation, so Rola, let's take it to the personal level. You've published about your experience as a lesbian Muslim. Tell us what it's like for you, what this has been like for you, both on a personal journey, but also as you see yourself in the larger the scheme of things.
Yeah, I mean, I think I want to echo what my fellow guest said. I think it definitely is two spaces that someone like me and my, folks in my community and others like me have to deal with. It's, what happens when someone with a Muslim background attacks someone of your own background as well, which is your LGBT identity. It is really difficult, but I feel, though, that it is up to us to educate and inspire and really spread the reasons and the connectivity that you have to whatever religion that you adhere to, as well as if you are privileged enough, and I do underscore that, if you're privileged enough to come out as well, to make that loud and known and proud at the same time. I think it really is. The onus is on folks who are privileged enough to come out to also at the same time be very be just as vocal about their whatever their religious identity is, for this very reason, to show that you cannot just blanketly say blanketly say Islam is against something or Christianity is against something, because, to be completely honest, I mean, they are all just, historical documents up to interpretation. And, the manifestation, to Ani's point, of what the religious texts say about homosexuality was certainly not what it was like centuries ago. So I would also take heed into actually, making blanket statements like Islam is against or is not against, or Christianity is for or not for. It really is up to those societies and those spiritual and religious leaders who are interpreting those texts. And one could, by the way, one could say the same about, for instance, the Constitution, which is also a historical document, which is also now up for interpretation as far as the Second Amendment, which, of course, ties closely to what happened in Orlando and many other massacres in our country. So, yeah.
So I want to stay with you for just a moment. We've talked about how it's there's a dual challenge here for LGBT Muslims, first to negotiate a family or culture that may not accept them and perhaps worse. And on the other hand, there's the dealing with homophobia. I want to zero in specifically on the experience of LGBT Muslims as one, perhaps, of many, right? The experience of being a lesbian within the LGBT community at large. Is there another layer here that we need to uncover?
I'm sorry, you're saying being a lesbian within the LGBT community?
Yeah, so how is it, as a lesbian Muslim, how are you received? What has your experience been within the larger LGBT community?
I see. Well, you want me to be completely honest. I think I have been, I'm going to first say what my experience is, and then I'm going to say what I believe others' experiences have been. But
okay.
But I do
okay.
believe that that I'm very, very fortunate enough to be to have been in the Bay Area for, you know, when I came out. And I feel like there was really kind of a fantastic community and support group there that I really couldn't have survived without. And that is for, you know, SWANA folks and Muslim folks and brown folks, I suppose, in the LGBT community. So I felt nothing but love and support there. But I do know that I am very, very fortunate to be in the Bay Area than, say, in some places in the South or the Midwest and other folks where my brothers and sisters definitely do not have that lucky privilege. I will say, though, that I did spend some time in my high school and university days in Oregon, in a small town called Beaverton, and I will say the Islamophobia there was that I was subjected to was extremely painful, especially as a teenager trying to acclimate to the U.S. culture moving from the Middle East. And I can only imagine that if I was out then, what that would have done to me. So like I said, I feel like I was very, very lucky and very privileged. I do understand that now I'm living in the Bay Area, but I do acknowledge that all around the country, that is absolutely not the case.
Eunice, do you have some more insight to share on this question of the experience of LGBT Muslims within the larger LGBT community?
Indeed. I've had many conversations with gay Muslims about their experience as Muslims, because they identify. What was really incredible in the conversations and interviews I had is that they identified first as Muslim before they identified as gay. So their religious identity, which is also their social and cultural identity, was very important to them. And even the individuals who really renounced their religion before 9/11 due to the conflict with their homosexuality, They found themselves in a position after 9/11 to defend their community, to defend their religion. And what happened after 9/11, in many of the accounts that I heard painfully, was that they have many members reported, especially in the United States and in Britain and in France, they began to experience a kind of a perception and marginalization within the gay community, especially those who are seeking to date or who are on certain dating websites and they disclose their identity, their race, their religion, that they were not getting as much contact and as much community. And I had a report from this fellow who grew up in Saudi Arabia, who is living here in the United States, who said that before 9/11, it was easy for him to find dates and to find sexual connections. And after 9/11, it has become very difficult when he disclosed that he was from Saudi Arabia. So that tells us, even within the larger LGBT community in the West, that the whole narrative of post 9/11 around Islamophobia and fear of Islam has even gotten to the hearts of the most progressive members of our community, who are the LGBT. Having said that, that's not necessarily across the board, because we also know that in our LGBT community at large. They are very well-educated folks who educate themselves, who understand the issues, who are able to tease out the different layers, and they understand. But there is one thing that's very common, even in my conversations with people here in the Bay Area, that there is, when people hear the word Islam, that they stop. They have to think about it. They have to process it. Even the most open progressive people that I know. And that tells us the layer of difficulty that gay Muslims have to experience. And another element that is really very important here to mention is that the gay Muslim community comes from cultures that are collectivist in nature, high context culture, where the individual is not important. It is the community that is important. So when a gay man or a gay woman decides to come out, the whole family comes out. The entire community comes out. And therefore, the cost of coming out is incredibly huge. And that's why many gay men and many lesbians do not make the choice to come out openly to their communities, because their families and their friends within their Muslim community will pay a price of becoming a pariah, will be becoming marginalized, becoming punished in some fashion. So they experience marginalization within their own direct community, and then they experience some of it within the LGBT community. And you can just imagine the difficulty of what it means to belong and to have community in a world that is very complicated as the world where we live today.
I want to reintroduce the program in case you're just joining us. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're speaking about what it means to be gay and Muslim with our guests Ani Zonneveld, president and founder of Muslims for Progressive Values, Eunice Morshid, adjunct professor of communication studies at Cal State East Bay, and Rola Selbach, award-winning filmmaker of Three Veils. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. Have you had to reconcile your sexuality and your faith and your family? What are your takes on the issues that we're talking about, especially in the wake of the Orlando shootings? The number to dial to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KALW website, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So, Rola Selbach, I wanted to go back to you in light of Eunice's comments. Talk a little bit more, if you will, about your own personal experience in negotiating your identity, your identities, and your family and community.
Yeah. To echo what Eunice said, he brought up a fantastic point, which is in a culture like ours, it's very, very high context. So when you come out, your whole family comes out. What does that mean? That means that you are now representing your whole family and community. And so you are absolutely more terrified to come out because you're not just representing yourself. So I'll give you a very good example to what you asked about personal experiences of mine. So when I was making Three Veils, which had one of the only Muslim Arab lesbian characters in cinema, I had to reconcile whether or not, to be honest, whether or not I would put my real name as being the writer and director of the film, and that is something I absolutely grappled with. I couldn't sleep at night. I was mortified. I was scared for what would happen to my family. I didn't mind if I was at risk, if my reputation was at risk, even if my life was at risk, because I did receive death threats, certainly. But to Eunice's point, I was more afraid of what would happen to my family. But then in the end, of course, I decided to use my real name. I thought, I absolutely need to pave the way and be above, the fear, and pave the way for others to be able to do the same, and to live in their truth.
Ani, go ahead.
Yeah, so as a Muslim, we're a grassroots, faith-based human rights organization, and we've been doing LGBT rights since Prop 8, so that's 2008. And one of the key things for us, I'm a straight ally, but I've been diehard supporter of LGBT rights. And Rolla, of course, we've always been there for your movies back when you were still drafting it. And drafting the script. But one thing, you know, speaking to both the and Rolla and Eunice, speaking about community and families, because it's not just about them, it's about their families. For us, it was really important to create communities that was inclusive so that LGBT people could come out, could bring their families. And that's been a real challenge because even though they're very private and they come out to me, for example, or to members of our community, they're really petrified at the idea of maybe meeting someone within the progressive Muslim community that was not as LGBT friendly and that would disclose to their family. So for us, having to empower LGBT to come out and in our community, you know, being accepting of LGBT is one of our philosophies. If you're going to be discriminating, if you're going to be upset about Islamophobia, then you have no right to be complaining, and you have no right to be discriminating against another minority group such as the LGBT community. So for us, we don't compromise on that issue. And when it comes to defending LGBT rights, we use the scholarly works of, say, Scott Kugel to educate LGBT Muslims about their rights, about their right to be Muslim and to be gay.
Say more about that.
We work with scholars of Islam such as Scott Kugel, mm-hmm. In adapting their scholarly work to the lay person's level so that we can educate straight and LGBT Muslims about the rights of LGBT Muslims within the context of Islam. And this is really important because a lot of the prejudices against LGBT is coming as a result of a twisted interpretation of Islam. And that also feeds into the Islamophobia, by the way, right? So yeah. So if we Muslims are going to be able to do away with Islamophobia, we will have to also address the homophobia within our community. And this has been Muslims for Progressive Values position for a very long time. We educate the public about LGBT rights in the context of Islam, and we also defend LGBT rights on the international level when Muslim-majority countries use Sharia law as an excuse to persecute LGBT people.
So I know, Eunice, you wanted to say something. I just want to ask you one more question, Ani. Are there other imams like yourself? How widespread is your point of view? Let's put it that way.
It's not easy. It's really tough. In America, 42% of American Muslims, A, strongly agree, B, agree with the Supreme Court decision for marriage equality, 42%. But not a single imam, not a single traditional mosque have come out. So what we're doing is we're challenging the traditional Muslim leaders, the mosque, the Islamic institutions, to come out and pledge to do away with homophobic teachings. And that's what we're trying to do in the next month. That's our campaign. But it's difficult. I mean, we do same-sex marriages. We've been doing it. That's part of our policy. So all our chapters in the United States, that is one of the services that we offer. And there's a few of us that do it.
So have you gotten any traction?
What do you mean by traction?
Traction
from
other imams.
From these mosques? No.
So is
actually,
it's...
I can speak to that, Joseph.
Go ahead.
We're beginning to see there is an imam in Britain. His name is Sheikh Zaki Badawi of the Ealing Muslim College, who is very vocal on the issue of homosexuality and the need for the community to come together into a more progressive and liberal understanding of what that means. And the point that he makes, which I think it's very excellent, and he goes around the world and he speaks about this element, is that if we are going to discriminate against members of our community, we're doing the same thing that the Islamophobes are doing to the Muslim community. And he is exactly really using that tagline in order to really get a lot of young imams that we're seeing in places like Morocco and Jordan that are at the forefront or fighting, you know, devious and fundamentalist interpretation of Islam. These young imams that are coming to the fore, that are being looked as a role model among the youth, they're beginning to speak the language of liberals. And they are saying the following. They are saying that homosexuality is wrong. they're not saying it's right. But they're also advising that just because we disagree with something, we should not attack it, we should not discriminate against it, and definitely we should not create a hate element to it. And they use the metaphor of abortion in the Catholic faith, where the Catholic community, they believe that abortion is wrong. But at the same time, you know, the Vatican makes it very clear that we should not be discriminating or mistreating or doing any ill will to people who engage in abortion. We're beginning to see young Muslim clerics learning from the experience of Christianity and Judaism that has to travel from a very fundamental, rigorous, and inflexible interpretation into a more open and flexible interpretation of certain elements that affect family, identity, and relationships. And I want to make one point about the cost that gay Muslims have to pay that gay Christians and gay Mormons and gay Jews do not have to pay. And the cost is security. I'll give you a very personal example. Recently, when I went home to Morocco, I was standing at the immigration door in order for my passport to be checked. And I gave my U.S. passport. And this fellow, young man, who was looking at the computer screen, he looks at me and he said, "You are a professor?" I said, "Yes." And he said, "You published some work on homosexuality and Muslims." And I began to turn my head and I said, "Yes." And I was just, my heart began to race. And he asked me, "Why are you writing about gay Muslims? You couldn't find anything better to write about?" I said, I stopped because I was not anticipating the question, and I was threading a very fine line because I'm coming into my country that still have a sodomy law. And I paused and I said, "Well, you know what? I am a social scientist and I'm interested in the experience of other people. There is nobody who writes about gay Muslims, and I think somebody needs to give them a voice, and that's my responsibility as a social scientist." And he looked at me and he smiled and he said, "Be careful. Be careful. You or your family might pay a price someday." And I just grabbed my passport and I got out of there as soon as possible because it was not in my benefit to have a conversation with an immigration officer in a country where there is still a sodomy law that the French gave to Morocco, because Morocco never had any sodomy laws before the French occupation. So this tells you, if this is a case in Morocco, a very progressive, liberal, open country, what do you think a gay Muslim is going to feel when they go to Saudi Arabia, when they go to Iran, when they go to Pakistan, and how they need to camouflage and protect their life? So safety and life.
But Eunice, you know, I think they're much more, like you're talking about the young imams that are shifting to more of like tolerance rather than hate. That's a shift. That's a huge shift, right? But that's not happening in America. I think the difference is that in America there's a lot of doublespeak. Like when all these imams came on CNN and claimed that we've always stood shoulder to shoulder with the LGBTQ community, that is so not true. They've never done that. They've always been on the opposite side on LGBTQ rights, from ENDA, from Prop 8, from basic civil rights. And the fact that that conversation is happening in the Muslim world, it is because it hits closer to home, because the issue of radicalism is so destructive in the Muslim societies in the majority of countries. And here we're privileged. And so I see a much more honest discussion, conversation being had in the Muslim world than here in America.
I would agree with that. I would certainly agree with that. And I think the reason why is that because we're still at a level where we're trying to figure out the Muslim community as a whole in this country, the whole narrative of Islamophobia, and what is the place of Muslims. And people are still stuck in the area of who speaks for Muslims. They think that we have the ignorance or the lack of knowledge about what's going on here, is that the lay person thinks that there is an equivalent to the Vatican in the Muslim world, and somebody should be speaking up and somebody should be being the voice of the liberals. But that's not the case. Islam is an incredibly, the Muslim community is as diverse as its countries, and no one person can speak for the Muslim community. And the other element that we have not spoken about yet is immigration. most of the Muslim communities living in America and Europe are immigrants first, and they share that experience of being dislocated as immigrants first. Mm. So there is that level of complication of being an immigrant, and how do you create community as an immigrant? And then your community, which is the Muslim community, is under attack because of what's going on politically around the Muslim community. So so that's why we're not really seeing the voices that we would like to see here in North America, like we're seeing in Britain and other countries, about this very difficult issues.
I want to reintroduce the program at this point. It's City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and there we're hearing from Yunus Morshid. He is adjunct professor of communication studies at Cal State East Bay. Earlier, we heard from Ani Zonneveld, president and founder of Muslims for Progressive Values, and Rola Selbach, award-winning filmmaker of Three Veils. Again, the phone number to dial to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You could also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So let's go to Sato from San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Salam alaikum. Alaikum salam. Good evening.
Alaikum salam.
This is the first time I ever called in a KLW on the air. I wanted to make a couple of comments. I almost became a Muslim myself, but the one thing that stopped me in the past was the homophobic aspect. And I've listened to alternative radio quite a bit and heard many speakers, and I've learned quite a bit about the Wahhabi school, you know, that unfortunately is taking center stage in the Muslim Islam community, and it's a very violent and very kind of, what's the word I'm looking for, a militant and fundamentalist sort of thing, especially out of Saudi Arabia, and which happens to be the most homophobic country on the planet, as far as I'm concerned. But anyway, it turns out that about two centuries ago, you also had the colonization of the Middle East by France and the UK in particular. And they, at that time, had imported this homophobia.
So, Sato, I'm sorry to interrupt you. We actually covered this at the beginning of the hour. I'm curious if you have a question or comment for our guests.
Well, I kind of wanted to, on the first part, the Wahhabi school in particular, if anybody could comment on that, anybody, you know, there.
And I'm going to have you take your answer off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
The influence of the Wahhabi school is tremendous and at the same time limited. How is it tremendous? In the 70s and the 80s, and in the 90s, Saudi Arabia spent billions of dollars in building religious and cultural centers in the West and in around the world in order to really be the spokes country or the spokes or the voice for Islam. And I think that countries like the United States and Britain, they have made a serious mistake by accepting those kind of donations and making those kind of allowances, because what it did is that it flooded much of the knowledge base sources of some very specific interpretation of community, relationship, sexuality that most of the Muslim world does not share.
Okay, I'm gonna need to move on. We got another caller here. Sorry, we have Eid from Berkeley.
Hi, good evening.
Good evening.
I'd like to start the conversation with asking you a couple of questions. Number one, who benefits from the action of this bloody so-called Muslim, which I really consider neither Islamic or state or anything? Most of their victims, almost 99% plus, are Muslims. Not to mention the countries they destroyed. You know, Syria, Iraq, Libya, and so on. So who benefits from it? And, you know, they did murder a few hundred in France, Belgium, and the United States. But they murdered hundreds of thousands in the Middle East. The second question is, why now? Why now? When you have the rise of the extreme right-wing groups, not only in the U.S., but in Europe as well. People like Trump and the rest of them. Why now? You know why? The followers of these bloody groups are the stupid idiots. They violate the rules and pillars of Islam every day. They murder innocent people, rape women and the children. So Muslims are the biggest victims, not to mention the shaming in religion itself and the 1.5 billion Muslims in the world. The fact is, we have to wake up. The leader of I never called them ISIS, ISIS the great ancient Egyptian goddess, call them Daesh or ISIL, as Obama calls them, their followers are stupid idiots. They have no idea about Islam. But the leaders, they really are, and many proof. You have to go online, get credible sources. The agents for the U.S., how Clinton supplied them with money some years ago.
Okay, we're going to have to move on. Thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
So I wanted to, one of the things that our last caller mentioned was referencing back to the Orlando shooting. I wanted to bring this back and couch it back in the issue that we're focusing on tonight, which is LGBT Muslims. There's a lot of unsubstantiated reports that the shooter, Omar Mateen, was himself gay. And it's there was an article as recently as yesterday in the New York Times about this. And it seems like something that's very important to people to figure out. Why do you think I'm putting this out to the panel here? Why do you think it's important to establish what Omar's sexual orientation was?
Oh, it's incredibly.
If I may answer that,
yeah.
Go ahead. So it's for me it's self-evident that he was a self-hating, an extremely self-hating homosexual. And why do you think that came about? That came about because of his upbringing. Like I had explained on top of the hour of how you cannot be gay and Muslim and you are doomed to hell and so on and so forth. And if you, I mean, there are schools actually out there that basically demonize homosexuals on a daily basis, as like, you know, in sermons and what have you. And so if that is how you've been demonized from a child, I know I know lots of gay Muslims that are so traumatized by their upbringing, by the demonization, by their own parents for being gay. It's a dark place to be in as a human being, and I think this is really important, and that's why we challenge the religious leaders. For them, you know, they did this declaration called the Orlando Declaration. Well, there was I think about 120 signatures from supposed Muslim religious leaders in America, and basically claiming that you cannot, there's only two ways of arguing. You cannot criticize Islam because then you're Islamophobe, or you are you're either with us or you're against us conversation, and that is a false narrative, because there's a third category, and that is we need to talk about the homosexual identity of this murderer, because it is as a result of all of this twisted teaching that has resulted in the self-hatred that has resulted in such a destructive act. And for them to wash it off as if, like, oh, we have not, it's not our responsibility, well, I'm sorry, they've got blood on their hands, and they need to address that.
I echo that sentiment, and I think there is enough evidence that internalized self-hatred that comes and internalized homophobia in any person, regardless of creed, religion, or ethnicity, leads to self-destructive behavior. We all know that many gay men, mostly less gay women, engage in very self-destructive behaviors. Might that be drugs and safe sex because of self-hatred. And I do believe it's very
suicide.
Established.
Suicide, even suicide, right?
even suicide. And I think it's very important to establish the sex. I think it's going to be difficult to do so. We have reports of him being at the Pulse Club, being a regular there. There are reports of individuals that he has communicated with for sexual favors, etc. This is the FBI still working on the case. There is no confirmation. But I think this is definitely most likely a case of very severe self-hatred that turned into a monster. A monster that took the lives of many other people and left the LGBT community and the Muslim community sad and wondering why
why. And I hope that the FBI and anybody who's doing any investigation gets to the bottom of this.
Rola, did you want to say more?
No, I think they summed it up. They summed it up very, very well. I think no matter what, to Ani's point, I think that in the wake of tragic events like Orlando, I think it's important that the religious leaders in America wake up. And it's to Ani's point, only now are they speaking up and pretending that some of them that they've been with the LGBT community from the beginning. That means that they find it now in their best interest. To actually align themselves with the right side of history, which I actually think is a positive, even if it isn't fairly true. But I do think that conversations like this, like the ones we're having, actually push the Muslim imam.
So, Rola, I'm sorry, you're breaking up quite a bit there. I'm not sure if it's on our end or yours, but I think we got what you were trying to say. So where does this conversation go from here? We have about 12 minutes left in the program, and we've talked a little bit about changing the preaching, but how does this happen on a day to day level? What's the strategy here, Ani?
Well, the strategy for us is to push back hard against that that sort of hateful teaching, which is un-Islamic at its core. I mean, the opening passages in 99% of the verses in the Quran, God the most gracious, the merciful. Well, how about the most compassionate and so on? And it's about time Muslims actually practice what they claim to be preaching. And so we're pushing, we're hoping that, and hopefully if there's any moms and religious leaders out there that's listening to this show, do share this pledge that we're putting out there. Come to visit the mpvusa.org website and write to us and make a pledge that you are going to no more teach this homophobic teachings in your institutions. We welcome, especially the Zaytuna Institute, which is not far from you, this liberal, supposedly liberal institute. So we're pushing hard. We're not going to allow 49 lives die in vain. We think this is the opportune time to really make the point, make the case against this teaching within the Muslim community. This is it. It's now or never.
Yeah. I would definitely support that suggestion, and I will add a little bit more. I think Harvey Milk said it beautifully when he was really fighting for LGBT rights. He said that the more of us that come out, the more our neighbors know who we are, the more our families know who we are, the more our teachers know who we are, the more human we are going to become to them. And I think it behooves the gay Muslim community to really sum up the courage and let their voice be heard in any way that they can do that, in a safe way, in a possible way. And also, we have to stop burying our heads in the sand. Islam, I mean, the Prophet, before he died, he said, I brought you this religion in such a way that it has to be good for any time, at any place. And what he meant by that is that use the instrument of his jihad of trying to adapt your religion to your times. And I think the clerics and the imams and the people who lead the Muslim community need to stop burying their head in the sand, look around, see how the world has changed so much in the last 25 years, and really try to adapt their teaching and their attitude and their perceptions to the current realities of time. And I think that is something that we need to do, the teachers, the community, and above all, I encourage my gay Muslim brothers and sisters to come out there and let their voice be heard. I try to give them a voice through my research, and I think that's not enough. We need more. We need more outlets for the voices to be heard.
So I want to turn to the other part of that question, which is what should the LGBT community be doing to help advance this concern of gay Muslims?
I personally think that, I am not a big proponent of having dividers. This is for this and this is for that. We have a subgroup called gay Muslims. I like the idea of all being one community, but I think the LGBT communities and LGBT organizations who fight for LGBT rights, they need to invite, they need to open the door, look for gay Muslims who have experiences, speak with them, give them a platform to share their experiences, include them in your outreach agenda, give them a microphone, give them a name. And I think that's something that organizations who fight for LGBT rights need to be very inclusive and realize that there is a segment in the world like gay Muslims who are not enjoying the same rights as they are enjoying.
Rola, you spoke earlier about your sense of privilege in this regard, and that you were able to come out. Say more to this point that Eunice is making about sort of where does the responsibility lie within the LGBT community, and within pockets of LGBT Muslim sub-communities to really bring this forth.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't have said it better than Eunice and Ani about really, I think the onus is on us who are gay and who do identify as being Muslim to really be very loud and very proud about who we are in both of our identities. And I think that it is very important, I mean, not just for organizations, certainly, but maybe folks out there are wondering, well, what can I do? I'm not part of an organization, and I'm not a religious leader. I think it's really important to reach out to folks who might be Muslim and LGBT, even on Facebook or on Twitter. Do I know anyone who's gay and Muslim? You know, go have coffee with them. Go find out more about them. Go make a friend. I find that in a lot of these cases, the second that you really put human emotions and human feelings and human friendship in place of just labels, I think the whole conversation changes for people in their minds. And I think that it's extremely important to open your hearts and to really, really stretch to be enlightened and to go talk to people who are not like you, whomever that may be.
We have a comment from Ken here in San Francisco. Maybe Ani, you could help us with this. Is there a place for LGBT Muslims to worship?
Yeah, in our community, it is an inclusive community. That means we encourage LGBT people to lead prayer, to do the sermon, to partake, to take leadership and spiritual leadership, not just coming to pray. And it's also a space where we say we pray Mecca style, meaning we don't segregate, because in Mecca we don't segregate when we pray. And that also enables trans Muslims to stand wherever it's comfortable for them and not have to, you know, make that decision to stand in the men or women section, because that's artificial. So we have 6 chapters in the United States, and we are starting one up in San Francisco, as a matter of fact, and we're looking for a particular leader to take the lead. But if there's any volunteers out there, I welcome you to write to me at info@mpvusa.org. Basically, Muslims for Progressive Values is a community, like I said, a grassroots community that is inclusive, and we've always been so. But we're in 6 cities. You know, there's not enough of our chapters to go around.
So we have a couple of tweets I wanted to read out and perhaps have you respond. Dalili tweets, as immigrants, most of us feel that we are fighting 3 fights. And I think that means being immigrants, being gay, and being Muslim. And then another tweet from Brooke who says, America's Islam is very radical and conservative. Muslim organizations are anti-LGBT. So it sounds like there needs to be some convincing here that...
Actually, that person is wrong. American Muslims are not conservative. There's enough statistics out there to prove that, especially Gallup, which basically said that the majority of American Muslims actually don't attend the traditional mosque. They have created their own third spaces, and we're now in 19 cities and in 12 countries throughout the world. So America is just one country that we're in. But the American Muslims are not radical. The American Muslims, the majority of American Muslims, are actually progressive. Like I said, 42% of American Muslims actually support marriage equality. That is quite substantial. and many more so, actually, you know, are much more liberal, and they are not represented by those leaders that we see on television. So the perception throughout the years has been that American Muslims are conservative because the media has always allowed and always gone to the conservative Muslims as representative of American Muslims. It's equivalent to thinking that Orthodox Jews in America represent Jews, all of the Jews in America, and that is obviously not true because it's the Reformed Jews that are the majority in America.
But I would say,
yeah, go ahead.
If I can
Rola.
Just say, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. That was Rola, and I'm sorry, you're not in the studio, so I can't tell who's speaking. Whoever wasn't just speaking there, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Rola. I do want to say there is an interesting lens to this, which is the fact that sometimes homosexuality, funny enough, is considered as being a Western value. And so what Dalili might be referring to is sometimes when you have Muslim communities in Western societies, especially if they have immigrated, you know, they feel that in order for them to keep their identity, they need to keep that. They need to stave off as much of the Western values as possible. And so I feel that sometimes homosexuality is seen as a Western value. And so because of that, you see that kind of backlash to communities that are trying to preserve their own identity, specifically some Muslim communities and immigrant communities in the West, for them to kind of, for that to even be more fuel to the fire as far as why they reject homosexuality.
When the history that you're quoting here is suggesting completely another story,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That in fact homosexuality existed long before
yes.
Muslim countries were, Muslim groups were colonized.
That's exactly right. That's why I said ironically. Exactly right. Yes.
Right. So in the last minute or so, what kinds of resources are any of you aware of for gay Muslims who are looking for support? We talked about the religious possibilities, but that's just 19 chapters in across the country. There's still a lot of country to cover. What other options? What other resources are people aware of that the people who might be listening might want to reach out to?
Well, I think it depends where the individuals live. I think it's important to, if they live in a big city like New York or Chicago or LA or San Francisco, I think there are plenty of groups and organizations that support, LGBT folks who identify as Muslims. They can be very inclusive here in the Bay Area. For example, we have a group known as Swana Back. So that's a way to start, and the other way, my other advice is to be inclusive. There are therapy groups and there are therapists who specialize in cultural and multicultural issues. These are good resources. These are individuals and groups that have some sort of a support system for people who are multicultural, who identify as more than one person. I think it's good to learn and grow in those settings where there are a lot of individuals who share similar experiences.
And we're going to have to stop this emerging conversation here. And I want to thank my guests, Ani Zonneveld, president and founder of Muslims for Progressive Values, Eunice Morshid, adjunct professor of communication studies at Cal State East Bay, and Rola Selbach, award-winning filmmaker of Three Veils. Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening.
Thank you very much.
For a link to this and other City Visions shows to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at klw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb. We'll be off for the 4th of July holiday. Join me in 2 weeks. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.